Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 18th of March, these are our main stories. Countries around the world are introducing tough new measures to restrict the movement of people as the number of those infected with the coronavirus passes 200,000. There have been further steep falls in stock markets despite promises of huge financial aid packages from governments. Joe Biden has swept a victory in Florida, Illinois, and Arizona, accelerating his momentum in the race to be the Democrats' candidate in November's US presidential election. Also in this podcast, abortion is no longer a crime in New Zealand and in South Africa. As the number of coronavirus cases rise, fears grow about the spread of the disease in crowded conditions.
You know what? I'm very worried about it. Like, I talk about it every day. We are going to struggle because, yeah, it's my neighbour. If I catch it, he's going to catch it. Everyone, they're going to catch it.
The coronavirus is continuing to have a huge impact across the world, with countries closing their borders and imposing lockdowns on their own communities to try to decrease the spread of the disease. Belgium has become the latest European nation to follow the trend. People can go out only for work, essential shopping and exercise, including dog walking. Similar measures in Spain have resulted in fines for nearly 800 people who broke the rules in the capital, Madrid, alone. The Nigerian government says it will stop arrivals from any country where there are more than 1,000 cases of the virus. That pledge covers 13 countries, including the US, China, Italy and the UK. Meanwhile, Pakistan and Nepal have announced severe restrictions on international arrivals. Officials in Nepal say they're banning passengers from a range of countries, including all Europeans. In Spain, the Prime Minister there, Pedro Sanchez, said his country had never lived through anything like it.
This disease, in addition to being silent, is cruel because it punishes us in the quality that makes us human, our need to live together, think together, and act together in community.
Gavin Lee is our correspondent in the Belgian capital, Brussels.
Basically, public life is severely reduced. It's not quite as extreme, I think, it's fair to say, as the French and the Spanish controls. I mean, it is the only difference is, you know, in France, where everything is open, but food shops, pharmacies, I think there's a few tobacco stores as well, the tobacs. But actually, here in Belgium, as of an hour ago, you are able to go to the library, for example. You are able to go to get your hair cut. You are able to go for a walk or cycle with a family member, but you have to be 1.5 metres apart. And so there are still some very heavy restrictions. For example, you can't be with groups of friends. It's simply not allowed. And Sophie Wilmers, the Belgian Prime Minister, said it is a sacrifice you have to make because of this domino effect, she said in her speech to the nation last night. There is no other option than to take this step. So she left almost a couple of things, like the libraries, like the hairdressers, to say we don't want to clamp down entirely on public life, but you have to get used to being indoors. So that is, it started, and we're already being told that there are big queues outside supermarkets. It's irrelevant. Food stores aren't closing, but a lot of people are still panic buying. They have a word here, hamstering, to store excess of what's needed during this pandemic.
Gavin Lee in Brussels. Elsewhere in the world, Taiwan, which has been praised for its efforts to try to stop the virus, is to ban foreigners from entering the island after an increase in those infected. The Philippines has imposed quarantine measures on new arrivals. South Korea has done the same and restricted internal movement of people. Seoul is particularly worried about a fresh cluster of cases that emerged at a nursing home in the southern city of Daegu. 74 staff and residents in all have tested positive. Laura Bicker in Seoul has been telling me more.
Well, it was discovered just within the week. And what they found is that around 55, 56 patients have coronavirus and the rest are staff. It seems to have swept quite quickly through the nursing home. They haven't found the source of the outbreak just yet. When he says a nursing home, the elderly here were also being treated for various ailments. So they were there for treatment, not just to live. So it does seem that this is particularly vulnerable vulnerable group and one that the health officials are certainly concerned about. They are trying to investigate and they are trying to trace where this outbreak may have come from. But it's not the only cluster that we've got. There's another one south of Seoul where there's a hospital there where there's been an outbreak. And the head of the hospital also has coronavirus. He has come into contact with the vice health minister, who's now in isolation. They're now trying to find out how many meetings the vice health minister has had in the last weekend. We had been warned here in South Korea that it needed vigilance, that we were not to be complacent, that we were not to gather outside. And in recent days, I have seen more and more people creeping out of their homes, going to restaurants and perhaps even going back to work rather than working from home. I think what the health officials are saying with these clusters is, look, it's time to still stay inside if you can.
So is this a surge back?
I don't think health officials are feeling that. I mean, the surge came from a mass infection caused mostly because of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus, where thousands of members, 60% of all South Korea's cases still relating to the Shincheonji Church. So I think they're saying this is the kind of cluster outbreak that we can expect for months to come. I think they're saying this is for the long haul, just as others are warning right across the world that this is not going to go away very quickly and that we all have to be careful. Remember, here in South Korea, there are no lockdowns, there are no real restrictions in movement. And even though today they have said that people coming into the country from overseas have to spend 14 days in isolation, it's not a mandatory quarantine. They're not locking you down and monitoring you. They're just advising you. So right now, all of these advisories and cautionary messages are getting through. But I think people are worried, certainly health officials are concerned, that how long will that last and how long is the population going to be able to kind of sustain this social distancing campaign?
So if you're not locked down, what's life like then, Laura, living there?
You can still go out to restaurants. Restaurants are still open and in some cases are still quite busy. People are still using subways, buses. It's not as busy as it normally would be. This is a very social country. Apartments are quite small, so people tend to gather outside. You must wear a mask. People think you're bonkers if you don't wear a mask. And people are trying to stay away from one another and taking precautions. But it's not like life is in lockdown and there's certainly no panic.
Laura Bicker, in Seoul, in South Korea. One of the major concerns during this pandemic is the sheer uncertainty about what will happen in the coming weeks and months. The confusion is reflected once again in share prices. They've fallen again in Europe and Asia, in spite of huge government stimulus packages announced this week. Andrew Walker is our economics correspondent.
There has been a barrage of government announcements about steps to address the economic damage from the health crisis over the last 24 hours. The United States was one, and Wall Street did record quite strong gains. But investors in Asia and especially Europe appear to be much less convinced. Many commentators have said more is likely to be needed. In addition, investors are trying to find the right price for assets in the face of extreme uncertainty about the prospects for the global economy. That it's much worse than it appeared just a few weeks ago is obvious, but judging how much worse is extremely difficult.
Andrew Walker. Now to the African continent, and South Africa recorded its first case of coronavirus 10 days ago. It now has more than 1,000. All schools are being closed and foreigners travelling from badly affected countries are barred from entering. More than 1,000 passengers are being held on a cruise ship off Cape Town following a suspected case. Officials fear the virus could spread fast in poor, crowded neighbourhoods. Our Southern Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
Hello. This is Alex Township on the outskirts of Johannesburg. A poor neighbourhood, very crowded. A lot of people here don't have water at home, running water. They don't have toilets. There are communal taps. Understandably, the concern about coronavirus here has a particular urgency to it. Fundamentally, it's about poverty and about whether people can behave in the way that governments and health officials want them to.
We don't have money to buy the hygiene that we will protect ourselves. We don't have the drain, we don't have the toilet. We're living in a high risk.
So it's difficult with water?
Yes, it's too difficult. We have one tab, and then that one tab, where there's maybe 40 to 45 people using that one tab, so we must get the queue, then we are unprotected.
So if the virus comes here, what do you think will happen?
It's going to kill everyone because we are unsafely, because we don't have the hygiene.
There's a crowd of men here, and I noticed a couple of them doing these elbow bumps to each other, not shaking hands, but there's a crowd here, and they're playing cards. And, of course, a pack of cards shared between half a dozen people here, easy way to transmit a virus.
You know what? I'm very worried about it. Like, I talk about it every day.
Most people live five or more to a room. No chance to self-isolate. Shebi Mapiani has stopped cooking dinner to show me the cramped single room she shares with her husband and three children.
We are going to struggle because, yeah, it's my neighbour. If I catch it, he's going to catch it. Everyone, they're going to catch it. So we are in a very big danger.
Because they say to people, you must stay at home, you must not work. But that's not possible, is it, for people?
It's not possible because, like us, I don't have my own car. I need to use public transport. To be quite honest with you, I'm very scared. Me, because now I'm pregnant. I'm scared for myself, I'm scared for my unborn child. It's not safe for us.
Until now, the coronavirus has been slow to penetrate this continent, buying African governments valuable extra time to prepare. But it's here now, and as South Africa's health minister Zweli Mkhize acknowledged today, it's gathering momentum.
We think it's an explosive rise in the cases that are positive, which then becomes our biggest problem because each and every one of the individuals is capable of creating their own mini outbreak. We're saying that every South African is a soldier because each and every one has to take responsibility to fight this infection. But just for so that you have a sense of the lie of the land as we move into the future, we are determined to suffer as few casualties as possible.
And so this vast continent braces itself for the virus. Resolute, worried, in places extremely well prepared, but overall acutely vulnerable.
Our Southern Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding. In the US, the race for the Democratic nomination for November's US presidential election has led to the former Vice President Joe Biden's sweeping victories in Florida, Illinois, and Arizona. His rival, Bernie Sanders, now faces a big, perhaps insurmountable struggle. Mr. Biden has appealed to Bernie Sanders supporters to join his campaign.
Let me say, especially to the young voters who have been inspired by Senator Sanders, I hear you. I know what's at stake. I know what we have to do. Our goal as a campaign, and my goal as a candidate for president, is to unify this party and then to unify the nation.
Our U.S. correspondent David Willis says Bernie Sanders may soon withdraw from the race.
There's no doubt at all that the coronavirus pandemic has worked against Bernie Sanders. He loves the big rally. And of course, his mainly youthful supporters also love it. Well, that, of course, is one of the things that has had to be put to one side because of this virus. It posed considerable challenges to their campaigns over the last few days. Rallies were cancelled, fundraising events, get out the vote efforts were cancelled as well. And the candidates have had to settle for tele-town hall and live streamed events, and it posed logistical challenges as well. Some polling stations had to be moved today to alternative locations. Some polling staff didn't turn up for work because of anxiety over the virus. But surprisingly, perhaps, turnout levels in Florida and Arizona are actually said to have exceeded those of the 2016 Democratic primaries, largely because those states encouraged early voting and voting by mail.
David Willis. Now, could there be a glimmer of hope in this unsettling time of the coronavirus? Well, a team of Australian researchers aims to have patients enrolled in a nationwide trial by the end of the month for what they're hoping might be a possible cure for the infection. Professor David Patterson, director of the University of Queensland Centre for Clinical Research, is the lead scientist.
So we're going to test three different regimens. One is an old HIV drug, one is an old malaria drug, and then the combination of the two. So even though these are old drugs, they have been found to have activity in the test tube against the novel coronaviruses. So we're really exploiting these sort of collateral activities of these particular drugs. Now, of course, it's very nuanced because the vast majority of people do get better from the novel coronavirus. And so in order to really show that they make a difference, we're going to be studying more than 2,000 patients, and we are going to have a placebo arm. So there is going to be 1 in 4 chance that a person coming into the trial will not actually receive a potentially active medication. But that's really the only way we can do it, so that we can show it truly, truly does have a clinical effect.
Professor David Patterson, Director of University of Queensland Centre for Clinical Research in Australia. So, what other treatments are being considered? Our health and science correspondent James Gallagher told me more.
Pretty much any country that has coronavirus cases is testing drugs in its hospitals. And largely, they're looking to drugs that are already out there, other antiviral drugs or anything that might have antiviral properties. And the reason for that is because if it's already been testing people before, then we know that it's safe to give to people. Now, the question is just, does it work against the virus? Whereas if you start from scratch, you have to prove that it kills the virus and is safe to give to people. So it's like a little head start, really. The problem from some of the early data is that while you're getting some antiviral activity from some of the known drugs in patients who have the virus, it doesn't seem to be as effective in the patients who are the sickest at the moment. That's what some of the early data is showing. That might change in the coming weeks, but that's a problem.
But I suppose what this means is that something can happen now, whereas a vaccine is going to take months.
Yeah, exactly. So as I explained, that difference between using existing drugs versus inventing them from scratch, the vaccine we're inventing from scratch. So you've got to go through all the process of safety testing it before it can be given to people in proper trials. And that adds a huge amount of time. The hope, and it is a hope, that there will be a vaccine in 12 to 18 months. But this is doing vaccine research that would normally take a couple of decades on an unbelievably fast, unprecedented timescale, that there's still some doubt about whether that can be achieved.
Are we seeing a lot of international cooperation, though?
This is one of the things that the World Health Organization is desperately trying to enforce, because what emerged out of, particularly when China was first doing its research in hospitals, is there was just a desperate attempt to treat anybody in any which way that you could. If you've got somebody dying on a hospital table, then give them the drugs that you think might work in the hope that it does. But the problem is, while that might help that patient, we'll never really know for certain. And it's unscientific, so it's not actually informing how the rest of the world should treat people, because you're not doing things in a rigorous way. As you heard from that scientist there, they're going to give some people dummy pills so they know whether the drugs work or not. And the challenge is making sure this is done in a really scientific way and that information is shared so the world can learn what the best way of treating people is.
James Gallagher. A number of international athletes have accused the International Olympic Committee of risking their health after it was announced the Games in Tokyo are still scheduled to start as planned in July. Nigel Adderley has been following the story.
While training camps around the world are in lockdown, qualifying events are being cancelled, so it's very difficult for athletes to reach peak condition or to even reach the Games themselves. Katerina Stefanidi, the Greek pole vault Olympic champion, has accused the IOC of risking the health of both athletes and their families by asking them to try and continue to prepare. And the world heptathlon champion Katerina Johnson-Thompson says it's impossible for her to train because her training camp in France is now in lockdown.
And away from the Olympics, a dispute is also developing, what, in the tennis world?
Yes, the French Open has been moved from May to late September, which means it will begin only a week after the US Open at Flushing Meadows in New York. And the US Tennis Association have now criticised their French counterpart, saying it was a unilateral decision and such moves have to be made with the wider tennis community at the heart of it. And they haven't ruled out moving their tournament as well now. And as both are outdoor, the options are becoming increasingly limited as you head towards autumn in those areas. And the players as well won't appreciate either moving between a clay court and a hard court tournament so quickly.
Everything's been cancelled, isn't it, Nigel?
It has been, and that is the issue, I think, not just for these sports we've mentioned, but for the sporting community around the world for many years to come now, because athletes have to reach peak condition at a certain time in their lives and in the season. And of course, that's all been thrown out of the window now. We heard about the European Football Championships moving yesterday for 12 months. As a result of that, the Women's European Football Championships may have to move another year on themselves to accommodate that. So it is a very uncertain time.
Nigel Adderley. Still to come in this podcast, away from the coronavirus, we hear from the Kenyan performing artist Marcy Onsinyo about how she's using her roots to create music soundtracks for films.
One of my songs is called Waridi. I wrote it when I lost two people who are dear to me. And in the lyrics, in the melody, you can feel the highs and the lows, the emotion in the music, even if you don't understand the language.
Let's turn to some other news now. Abortion is no longer a crime in New Zealand after Parliament approved a bill removing the procedure from the Crimes Act. It'll now be signed off by the Governor-General to become law. The newsroom's Kate Gregan told me more.
Well, for a lot of people in New Zealand, this is a historic day because Parliament has ruled that abortion is no longer a crime. So this new law means that women up to 20 weeks pregnant will now have the right to decide if they want an abortion. Previously, two doctors were needed to approve one, and only if there was a serious danger to that person's health. So essentially, until now, women have been forced to lie about their mental health in order to get one. Now, in regards to getting an abortion after 20 weeks under the new law, it can only be approved if deemed necessary to save that woman's life or prevent serious injury. Now, the bill was passed with a healthy majority of 68 to 51, and it was also treated as a conscious vote, so MPs didn't have to vote along party lines. Here's what Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had to say about it.
There will be people on both sides of the argument who won't be 100% happy with the final version of the bill, but it is a huge improvement on what we have had in the past.
New Zealand is often viewed as a liberal country, but for many years, campaigners have called abortion laws in New Zealand archaic. Abortion has been a crime for over 40 years, Val, and despite a lot of noise from the public, no political parties had dared to tackle this because they were worried about backlash or other consequences. There are still a lot of people across the country who strongly oppose abortion, whether it's for religious or cultural beliefs. This had been one of Jacinda Ardern's key pledges in the 2017 election and something that many people had campaigned for years.
Kate Gregan. The Al-Qaeda-linked group Al-Shabaab has existed for well over a decade in Somalia. It controls much of the country, despite regular US drone attacks and the presence of international forces. Many of its fighters are forced to join, while others sign up for religious or financial reasons. The Somali government has offered an amnesty for those who defect. Many of those who do so end up in one of three rehabilitation centres. Our Africa editor Mary Harper was given rare access to one, where she met the director of the defectors programme, Mohammed Ali. He told her how religious scholars were brought into the centre to help de-radicalise the defectors.
All those scholars, they meet with them, sit down with them, ask them about the knowledge they have about their religion, what they have been told. They assess how much they are brainwashed, how much they are lied and misled. And then they give them the best advice about the righteousness and the right way of the religion of Islam in a peaceful manner.
And do the former fighters argue with them and say, you know, that these imams who are speaking to them now are wrong because they've learned a different kind of religion during the times they were living with Al-Shabaab, working for Al-Shabaab?
They don't argue with them because they don't have more knowledge about the religion. They are brainwashed, they are used because of their ignorance. That's why they are used. But now they are learning so they can understand the difference. All the people who are fighting for Al-Shabaab are people of young age who don't know the consequence and what they are doing, who don't have a knowledge about how they are doing this work and the harmful of this work and the problem they are causing. That's one group, and the other group is people who are not educated, so they are easily to be manipulated, brainwashed, to be misled. When they come here, we give them education, free education. They feel the difference.
I visited two of your centres, and both of them are kind of in the heart of the city. Don't the people who live around here feel frightened because you've got dozens of people who used to fight in Al-Shabaab, people who used to blow up hotels and other buildings right here in Mogadishu.
The problem always exists, and there's sometimes lack of mistrust because the name is still operating and committing crimes which can cause anger from the people. But still people are supportive. They are part of the forgiveness and welcoming so that they can get an opportunity to save many lives.
Mohammed Ali talking to our Africa editor, Mary Harper. Now let's hear from the Kenyan performing artist Marcy Onsinyo. She's developed a career creating soundtracks for movies using her experience and her African roots as an inspiration. Alan Kasuja recently met her in a restaurant in Kitale in western Kenya, where she explained what made her music sing.
I like to think of it as music that paints pictures. My main target is film. So I like to bring the expressiveness and the artistry of the music out. One of my songs is called Waridi. I wrote it when I lost two people who were dear to me. And in the lyrics, in the melody, you can feel the highs and the lows, the emotion in the music, even if you don't understand the language. And that, I believe, is ideal for film music. When you see the picture and you put the music with that, it just tugs at your heart.
I know you've told us about tragedy inspiring your music. What else inspires it?
Everyday life. I love nature. Everywhere I go, I record sounds from nature to use in my music. So you'll hear cricket sounds, you'll hear bird sounds. I think of the ocean. I think of everyday people walking, buses passing by, everything. Love. You know, love has a sound. Happiness has a sound. Everyday things.
And when you talk about water, I sense that you're particularly attached to water.
Yes, I am.
How does that inspire your music and why?
I was born and raised in Diani. Mandhari ya Diani, ufuo wapendeza.
Mawimbi baharini, asubuhi jua la chomoza. Which is on the coast in Kenya.
Yes, at the coast of Kenya. And just the beauty, the tranquility. Water is the elixir of life. My grandma used to say water is medicine.
Any artists that inspire you that I might know about? Or do you just inspire yourself?
I believe I inspire myself because I am a multifaceted artist. I grew up at the coast, where we have the British, we have German influences, we have Arabic influences, we have the indigenous Digo, Duruma. My father is Kisii. My mother is a mixture of Borana, Somali, Duruma.
You're just painting a really confusing picture right now.
Yes, yeah, so...
complete identity crisis.
Exactly. I've always had an identity crisis, and that has drawn me to culture. I am very proud to be African because even as Africans, wherever you go in Africa, we've taken up so many cultures, so many other cultures, especially the people at the coast. My grandfather is Barawa. So they come from Brava in Somalia, and you'll find influences of the Seychellois, of Italians, of Yemeni. So I think that's naturally African because we are the cradle of mankind.
lovely soothing music of the Kenyan performing artist Marcy Onsinyo, talking there to Alan Kasuja. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.